Welcome back to the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. Sentientism answers those two deep questions by committing to using evidence and reason and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Jenny Splitter. Jenny is an award-winning journalist and science writer covering food, agriculture, climate change, biodiversity, health and technology. Her work has been published in Vox, Forbes, The Observer, The Washington Post, New York Magazine and many other places. Jenny is a co-founder and contributing editor to the science communication project SciMoms. She's also a podcast host on the Animal Studies channel of the New Books Network, and her newsletter, Future Feed, chronicles change in the food system. I'd love to know what you think of the episode and more than 50 others already. Don't forget to work through our back catalogue if you're a new subscriber. Every person who reviews and rates or shares our podcast with a friend helps us nudge a few more people towards compassionate, rational thinking. You can find more about sentientism at sentientism.info or search for the word sentientism on your favorite social media platform. We're on Twitter, Reddit, Quora, Discord, Telegram, Instagram, Facebook, and most other places now. You'll be made welcome in any of our global community groups that are open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Jenny. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Very good. Thank you so much for making the time to join this series of sentientist conversations. And as we've talked about briefly before, I think some of your writing relates really nicely to the two big questions here that we like to ask. One is what's real? How do we understand reality? And what matters morally? What should we care about? And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to raise awareness and develop this really simple worldview called sentientism, which says when it comes to thinking about what's real, we should use a naturalistic approach that uses evidence and reason to try and understand reality, always imperfectly. And when it comes to what matters morally, the clue is in the name. We should care about all entities that are sentient, that have the capacity to experience suffering or flourishing. But I'm talking to people in this series of conversations who both agree with that philosophy or disagree with it. So it'll be fascinating to understand your personal story. But before we get to those two big questions, crazily big questions, how would you best introduce yourself and your work?
Thanks for having me. First of all, I'm excited to have this chat. I'm an independent journalist or freelance journalist, depending on which term you like. And I write mostly about food, farming, climate, science, some health stuff in there for just a number of outlets. Vox, Undark, 1-0 at Medium, just depends on the project, basically. But especially a lot of climate-related stuff these days.
Yeah,
and hot topics. I'm also a co-founder and contributing editor at SciMoms, which is a science communication project that kind of does evidence-based information for parents and caregivers.
Yeah, magic. That's great. Yeah. So to start with the first of those two deep questions, what's real? For many of my guests, that's a story about whether they grew up in a religious, a supernatural, spiritual context, or one that was more naturalistic or agnostic or atheistic, and how that side of their philosophies developed over time. So you can wind the clock back as far as you like, but it'll be fascinating to know your story and where you've got to now on that side of the question.
Yeah, I grew up in Santa Cruz, California, which is a very laid back town in California, Northern California. I was raised Reform Jewish, but there was only one synagogue in town. So it's kind of like everybody, no matter whether you were more religious or not, would go to this synagogue. And so it's more about like community and ritual and stuff like that. Yeah, I feel like I wasn't raised atheist or anything, but like my dad's become more spiritual as he's gotten older, but was atheist. And I feel like in the Jewish context, at least on the more like Reform side, it's definitely not heavy-handed with the God stuff.
Yeah.
Like my kids have been going to a Hebrew school. And I'm sure most of the parents there are like atheist or agnostic. It's just mostly about the ritual and the tradition and the history. And I think also a lot of the philosophy that has always resonated for me, the big, and I'm like no Jewish scholar, so don't expect accuracy of any kind.
But you won't be quoting the Talmud then.
No. But like the big concepts like tikkun olam, which is like repair the world, like just this idea of making things better, like what your responsibility is in that. And I think also just thinking about our community obligations, that was always a big thing for me. Like I still will go to high holiday services every year where like the Day of Atonement, it's not just about, well, I yelled at my kids and I did this. It's more, what did we all, how did we fail this year? Like, how could we all do better? And I think especially, again, like on the more sort of Reform side, which is really like taking the scripture and like making it relevant for today. And it's, again, not as, I don't know, it's just more about thinking about deep philosophical questions, I think, like through a Jewish lens, but not necessarily like you have to do this and don't do this. And it's not so much about the rules as that, like the argument, the discussion, the analysis. And I don't know, that's what I think about when I think about like my Jewish upbringing, is more of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And did you, were you more of a believer in the early days when you were a child, and that sort of drifted away and you've kept the culture and the ritual and the values, but left the supernatural stuff? Or how did that shift
pretty
happen?
Much. Yeah. I do remember as a kid having this like really naive sense of God, like taking care of all of us and stuff like that. And I remember it's, still sticks with me, like a kid in my Hebrew school was like, yeah, it doesn't work like that. Like bad things happen to good people. And I was like, oh, because I just had this like nice idyllic childhood. I was like very privileged in that way. Like nothing at that point had happened. When it was, even at the time, as soon as it left my mouth, I'm like, no, of course, like that's a kind of a silly statement. But yeah, it took a while, I guess, for me to start thinking about, okay, what does God exist and what do I feel about it? But like at some point, honestly, I just didn't really worry about it anymore. I don't know, which I actually think is common for a lot of Jews. It's like the things that I like, about, like I don't, who knows what's going on and whatever, but like the biggest things that I like are the holidays and cooking and just like the rituals, and not necessarily anything really necessarily too focused on God. Is God watching over me? Although I do remember a kid, one of my kids went through this thing of being like, God? And I'm like, and we were like, how'd you get that in your head? And my older kid was like, God's more of an introvert. I wouldn't expect a response right now. But that kid's now an atheist too. So that's kind of how it goes. Like you just figure they'll get there on their own.
Yeah, makes sense. The supernatural stuff faded into the background and you kept the bits you felt were valuable.
Yeah,
that's interesting. And it sounds like that was quite a natural, normal, unchallenging process to go through. You didn't feel any sort of existential angst leaving the supernatural stuff behind, and you're in a supportive environment, so it wasn't challenging.
Well, my dad was an atheist. Like I knew my dad didn't believe in God the entire time, so it wasn't like and like plenty of people I knew also were like that, so it wasn't any kind of tough process to come to that like conclusion or anything.
And you mentioned already that it's the sense of community and values and responsibility and making the world a better place, and those aspects that you've concentrated on, you've kept and you've moved through. And as the supernatural stuff faded away, was that partly just a sort of logical process of doesn't really make sense and it's increasingly less relevant to me? Or were there some aspects of the moral structures within certain aspects of Judaism that you had challenges with as well? Or was it much more about intellect and just logic?
I don't want to paint an overly rosy view of Judaism, because those kind of conflicts definitely exist. I just wasn't personally studying them that much. And I there's some famous rabbi who wrote this book trying to explain like why bad, I think it's actually called like Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. But it's something like, oh, there's, I don't know, it's some like hokey explanation. There's some bad stuff in the world and it's balanced by goods. And it's just like, what? That doesn't make any sense. But so those, I think those like conflicts, those exist for sure. It's just that I never did, was never really drawn to studying them. Like I was studying other things with my life. And I think also the way I was brought up, we weren't like, we went to synagogue for services and we did our thing, but it wasn't like this huge part of our life, I guess. It wasn't all consuming or anything like that. And I wasn't contemplating going on to study the Talmud or anything like that. So it just will settle where it settles, the thing.
Makes sense. And the second big question we come on to is what matters morally and what sorts of things we should care about. And it's interesting in the conversations I've had so far about the degree to which that sort of what's real side of people's philosophy links to what matters morally. So some people think there's a complete distinction between the sort of is and the ought side of things, right? There's facts of the matter and there's decisions about value, and they're completely distinct and you can't connect them. For other people, they're much more richly connected. So they're, for example, their religious belief is actually why they feel certain things are right and wrong. Now, from what you've said, my guess is that there wasn't anything in the sort of supernatural side, or maybe even in the formality of Judaism, that necessarily drove your morality was more of an intuitive sense of community and right and wrong? Or I'm interested in that link between the, I guess, the religious context, secular or otherwise, and how you thought about morality, even in those early days.
One thing I will say that I always found interesting about, at least the way it was presented to us in religious school, was like when we would learn about certain issues, moral issues, there was always a lot of layers of complexity. And yeah. Again, Orthodox is going to be a different, I'm not trying to say like, hey, Judaism yeah. is perfect and so yeah. nuanced, yeah. but it just so happened. We like the things I remember were, here's where you're, if you're closer to God or further away from God and not necessarily like sin and you're going to hell, like there yeah. isn't even that sort of hell concept. Now, even some of those, like later on, you might like, so for example, I remember in Hebrew school, they gave us this sort of big lecture on like sex and premarital sex. And it was like, if you're married, that's the closest to God. And going down the line, basically, this is just further away from God. Now, yeah. I guess stepping back, it doesn't make sense that we're going to judge premarital sex as being further away from God and all this stuff. But so it's, again, it's not like it's free from any problematic views. But what I took with me was just like, things are complicated, at least. And there isn't, this is bad, this is good. Yeah. All these people are going to hell. And I think when I was growing up, it was important to me because I was also in a small town, even though that's our town, like our city of Santa Cruz is very progressive. I grew up in the even smaller town of Aptos, which had a lot of like evangelical Christians in it at the time. And a lot of kids I knew were like going to Bible camp for the summer and coming back very, oh, if you don't believe in this, you're going to hell. And so for me, I think that's part of why Judaism was such a strong, something I clung to at that time. And also I could see it being the opposite of that. But, yeah. And I did all this stuff, like now thinking back on it, I did all this stuff to push back. Like I was like an AIDS peer educator in high school and stuff like that. Cause I think I like that complexity life and not here's everybody going to hell versus everybody going to heaven. Like,
yeah.
I at that age felt like that doesn't make sense. And because I'm born Jewish now, suddenly I'm all of a sudden on your out list.
And everyone has an out list. Yeah. And I still find that a shockingly crazy thing to tell a child that, right. you know, they or their friends will burn in hell for eternity. But yeah, it's remarkable.
And it was very California. I have a close friend who grew up in Harlan, Kentucky, where it was really like direct, whereas I feel like in Santa Cruz it was more, listen, it's no offense, it's just you are not going to heaven and yeah, you'll be yeah. in hell. Like, it's just, why are you getting mad, chill out. Like, it was very like passive aggressive, like why are you the angry one here? And at the time I felt super gaslit, like I don't know why I'm getting angry, of course I'm getting angry, you're being told by all your friends that you're going to hell at a yeah. time when you're like discovering your identity at 16, 17, like figuring out who you are. So it's yeah. not the greatest message to get.
It may seem an odd question to ask, but you've taken a lot of the culture and the values from that background, but you have, I guess, a naturalistic worldview now in terms of thinking about what's real and what exists. How would you describe the grounding of your ethics or your morality now? What matters? Because clearly someone with a very strict religious upbringing, in a way their morality is defined almost in terms of sometimes in terms of obedience or compliance. If I follow the rules, if I do what God tells me to, that's what good is. And for people who have a naturalistic worldview, we don't see that as a way of defining morality. We think of other things that define what good and bad are. So where have you got to now? If I asked you, what's the grounding of your morality if you have one?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I think it's hard to say exactly like where it all comes from, because I'm not exactly sure. Yeah, and it's funny because if you think about the Jewish rules about food and koshering, like those are like, not that we ever were brought up kosher or followed those, but they are like very like strict and there isn't a lot of complexity. It's just like, don't eat pork. That's it. That's the rule. Yeah. Like we're not going to explain why, it's just because we said so. So yeah. And again, those are the rules we didn't follow, and I only became familiar with the atheist community and communities and skeptics and that kind of thing in recent years when I started writing for a sort of a sub-blog of Skeptic. I don't know if you know Skeptic, yeah. but it's, yeah. So that was kind of my first introduction. And I think, I don't know, it's just weird. It's not like I necessarily take everything or want to take everything from those groups either, because I feel like sometimes the nuance is lost and I feel like the world is complicated and I don't have all the answers and none of us do. And
yeah,
I don't know. So in those ways, I think I've always still felt more comfortable in like the Jewish, in my local like Jewish community, just because I don't know. Yeah, I feel like there's more of a come as you are feeling. I don't know if that makes sense. Yeah, I guess because I was saying, but I think before we started, I think when it gets into morality, I'm like, it's complicated. I don't know. I don't have all the answers. I try to do no harm, do the best I can. I'm trying to avoid like bad people and whatever, like these like big black and white terms, and just try to get more into the sort of the complicated stuff with them as much as possible, which keeps conversations interesting.
Yeah. And I think I share that view of breathtaking complexity and nuance and almost a debate that's never over. But at the same time, I think the basics can be fairly solid. And I think you've touched some of them already when you talk about community, you talk about doing no harm. In a way, the foundation of it for me is a concern for others. I guess almost tautologically, that seems to be what morality generally is about. If once you've moved away from the supernatural stuff, that seems like a sensible grounding. And that you think that suffering is a negative thing, flourishing is a good thing. I don't like suffering. I'm pretty sure you don't either. And my decision to care about that sort of is morality.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think, especially during the pandemic, I think the feeling that sometimes we've lost sight of community has been really palpable for me, just because sometimes there's this disconnect between what am I doing? Am I worried about myself? What's my individual risk versus how is the community doing? Like how much COVID's in the community? Who isn't getting vaccinated and why? And where do we need to meet them? What information do they have or not have? I feel like that's been so on my mind in the past year or whatever since we've been in this, is we lose sight of that and just worry about ourselves and then end up bickering and fighting. And we see that a lot with, I don't know, my schools. It's a lot of like social media stuff where people just, I want this.
Yeah.
And that's what matters, instead of like, how can we all protect everyone as many people as possible, right? Like, how can we lower the risk for as many people as possible? That's been a really, I think, tough thing for a lot of Americans to wrap their head around for various reasons.
Yeah. The last year has made lots of people rethink some real basics. And in a way, it echoes somewhat timeless problem that I've just explored with some of my previous guests who looked into the evolution of morality, if you like. And and we've got both good and bad there in our heritage. And it's not just humans either, right? I think even non-humans developed proto-morality long before humans came on the scene. And there's good sides to that, or what we might now call good sides, right? There's kin and reciprocity and love and affection and compassion and empathy and the evolution of cooperation. But there's also in-group, out-group tribalism and aggression. And in a way, that's the legacy that humans as biological beings started out with. And we're still grappling with it now, both in terms of just our sort of evolutionary proclivities, but also the way our minds work and our psychology. We're often torn between those different things. And in a sense, that links to one of the important sub-questions here about what matters morally is, if you like, our moral circle or our scope of moral consideration. Because I think most humans would agree about doing no harm or trying not to cause harm or having compassion. There's a really critical question about, okay, but who do you care about and what do you care about? So I think even humans who make awful discriminations within the human species still feel compassion, right? They just feel compassion for a subset of humanity, and they haven't extended it out to consider all humans. And then we have the challenge, of course, given the clue is in the name, with sentientism. If humanism is, if you like, evidence, reason, and compassion for all humans, sentientism says, okay, but humans aren't the only ones that suffer. Non-humans suffer too, and they should matter morally. And those are, you know, both difficult journeys. So in a sense, it's compassion isn't enough. You've actually got to set your scope of moral consideration too. And that's another interesting journey that I'd be fascinated to know your thoughts on. How did your sort of scope of moral consideration shift over time? You've done some really interesting writing about animal farming and non-human animals. So yeah, that would be another philosophical journey I'd be interested to know your story on too.
Yeah, I feel like I have very unsatisfying answers for that part, because it's interesting. Like, I started out when I was first starting to write about some of the climate impacts of certain meats, I basically adopted like a reducetarian approach, if you know that organization, before I knew it was a thing. And then when I, but they're basically try to meet people where they are and say, okay, just reduce your consumption of meat and animal products. And so I'm going to cut back on beef. And then over time, it wasn't like I had an aha moment where I was like, I now see the that all animals have feeling and I'm magically going to change. But I just over time stopped eating meat. And part of it is that I cook, I think. So it was like, I could do it in these little bits of challenging myself. Oh, can you substitute this for this? And that's always been fun for me. Like the food.
It's almost like a challenge. It's like a creative challenge to what can you veganize this or that? Yeah.
I love that stuff. That's my, hobby, which is weird for a lot of people, but that I love doing that. And just seeing, oh, what can you swap out and make it taste the same and that kind of thing. And then so now I just have been trying it with dairy. But I think the big questions have always really overwhelmed me. And maybe it goes back to that same thing. Like, is there a God? I just never really wanted to go down that huge questioning path. And maybe that's why I was a lawyer in another life. And maybe that's part of it. Yeah. I don't want to debate. I don't want to do it. I'll leave that for somebody else. It's just too big of a question. Like I just start changing my behavior, which I know is like the opposite of evidence and reason-based thinking. What can I say?
I'm not sure it is. It's because it's, and this is one of the central topics we discuss a lot in this series, is because there's a sort of classical approach that we think people are supposed to take where you use evidence and reason, you think things through, you do the hard moral work, and then you change your behaviors. And that's often just not the way things work for people.
It's weird because I often come across these, and no, I love academics. I hope this doesn't sound insulting to any academics, but sometimes I will read philosophy papers that are very like rationalist, the sort of logical thing. And it probably is just PTSD from law school and being a lawyer, honestly, but I'll go like, I feel like you create this little world, like here's my factual setup and I'm going to make my argument according to my factual setup. And now I did it. So I'm done. Thank you. I won. Goodbye. Case closed.
Yeah.
But to me, it feels like that's not a human way of, or whatever, authentic way of conversing. Like I don't go through my day with my friends or my husband, my kids, anyone I know and being like, listen, I have 3 points for you. Yeah. and then I have evidence for you and I'm going to support each thing with evidence. And then when I'm done, you respond, you have 10 minutes to respond. Nobody has a conversation like
QED,
that.
QED. So yeah.
It's just my aversion to debates like that. I want to have conversations with people wherever possible and not do that. That said, of course, when I'm writing a piece, do I structure my, things logically? Yes. So I'm being a little disingenuous perhaps, but it's just, there's a part of me that pushes back against that, knowing that as humans, we have emotional responses. We want to go on an emotional journey sometimes, or maybe all the time when we make decisions, that we like stories, we like storytelling, we respond to that. I don't know. It's just like a war in my brain and I don't know the right answer, but.
Yeah. And I think we'll come back to that when we talk about the future, because in a way, I think the most important thing about the future is not so much technology or technical challenges or problem solving. It's more about the weirdness of human psychology. So yeah, I'll be interested to come back to that, because again, you've written about those different types of messaging and how that might work as well. But in terms of your moral scope of consideration now, would you say that you came into the sort of animal field, if you like, through maybe climate change or its other impact, and I guess come to a sort of moral realization that these entities matter morally as well and they're suffering cats? So would you say that your scope of consideration is like mine now, grounded in sentience, that capacity to suffering? Is that how you draw the boundary, or am I putting words in your mouth? Or
I have a hard, for me, I guess it's to avoid me having to figure out like the inner life of a mollusk or the spider in my bathroom. I mostly do just think, oh, I can minimize my harm by not doing this. Okay, maybe I can throw the spider outside or whatever. And because I think one of the first pieces I wrote where I really was looking at the sort of animal welfare research was a piece on feedlot beef and but then I went not even necessarily limited to that. It was just reading Jason Lusk's work, who like all the vegans know Jason Lusk, because he's this like animal or agricultural economist who's done tons of animal welfare research. He's not a vegan or vegetarian at all.
Yeah.
But he goes through every single animal and every setup, farm animal, I should say, every livestock animal, and trying to measure the suffering. And it's complicated when we get to like chickens and stuff like that, because like chickens are weird and they cluster together and do things that we wouldn't do to each other as humans, like peck each other and stuff like that. but or maybe we did that as humans.
Yeah, exactly. Depends which humans you're talking about.
That's true. That's true. So I read that and was like, what's going on inside a chicken? I have no idea. Like, it's different. I think rightly or wrongly, you look at a cow and they look cute and they're calm. And you think, oh, I have a sense of this animal's like inner life a little bit. Whereas with something like an insect or even just like a chicken where they're just like behaving so differently, you're like, are they suffering?
Fish is another example.
So I have the hardest time with fish. And that's the thing. I think Garrett Broad is someone who's done a lot of writing on this. He's a professor at Fordham, and I'm blanking on like his exact, I think it's like communications or something, but he writes a lot about like animal activism. And yeah, just like all the prejudices we bring, like dogs are cute and cats are cute, but we don't care about fish. We don't care about all these different animals. And yeah, I agree with that. I think the thing that was like a weird turning point for me is that I realized in the past few years, I was like, my adorable cat is a vicious murderer. And it's really weird that we don't talk about cats more often, how they may be adorable, but they're truly vicious murderers, at least mine. I don't know. It's and impressive in the way they can kill. But I think, yeah, we rarely, as I think most people I know do not, dig into these issues of all of our prejudices that we bring to the table and which animals we want to protect or not. And I find all that like really daunting. Like, I feel like when I look at this topic, I'm like, poof, that's complicated. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think that's entirely appropriate. You can tell my puppy here is, you mentioned cats, so she's just gone nuts.
Right.
I don't know if she heard you. But I think that sort of humility and that sort of uncertainty is exactly the right approach to take. And that's partly why in this sort of framing of sentientism, it doesn't have a list of which entities are sentient. It just says follow the science, and that science is uncertain and always changing, and we don't know. And personally, I think sentience is, like consciousness, likely just a class of biologically evolved information processing, really. It's just what's going on in our brains. In that sense, there can be enormous varieties of it, even with our own species. But as you go across other species, it can have lots of different flavors. And there may well be a great, gray areas, as you say, your mollusks or the super simple insects. Sea sponge is an animal, but it doesn't even have a nervous system. I think it's entirely right to be uncertain and to have humility and to have whole provisional and probabilistic beliefs as well. But at the same time, given the potential importance of the subject, is also be prudent and give benefit of the doubt where it's due to.
Yeah, and I think another thing for me is I don't necessarily with chickens have to know what's going on their inner life to know that the way like the poultry facilities are really unsafe for the people that work there, the conditions aren't good, there's pollution in the communities around them. So I guess I feel like, yeah, that kind of stuff. And maybe that's the journalist in me. It's just kind of follow the facts. And if I have enough of them, it's okay. Like that's something I can avoid doing in my own life.
Yeah, there are so many reasons all pointing the same direction. I like to joke that even if you're a human who only cares about humans, there's still a very strong argument to go vegan purely from climate, AMR, antimicrobial resistance, zoonotic disease, work conditions, and just the inefficiency of the process. But again, I'm biased. So now I'll take whatever reason, as long as it pushes in a compassionate direction. And that scope of moral consideration, I think, is important, even if it has fuzzy boundaries. And I think it's appropriate to have fuzzy edges and be uncertain about where we set it exactly. But there are some people who will challenge that sort of sentientist view and say, look, you've gone too far. Only humans really matter. And it's entirely appropriate for us to care about companion animals, but not about farmed animals. And I'd reject that and say, look, all sentient beings matter morally. But there's another way of challenging it, which says it doesn't go far enough. And it's quite topical at the moment, again, given some of the other topics you talk about, where people will go beyond from an anthropocentric thing focused on humans to a sentiocentric thing focused on all sentient beings, roughly animals. But some will go further and go to a biocentrism, which cares about all plants and living things, even if they're not sentient, and even further to an ecocentric or a holistic approach, where people will be concerned about species and habitats and ecosystems and maybe Gaia as a system and rocks and rivers. So I'm interested in your perspective on that side of the argument as well. Would you go even beyond sentience in terms of...
Well, I feel like, and I hadn't heard about that, but that, is something I've become interested in recently. And I feel like I'm behind on like catching up. Like I just have been discovering a lot of conservation work and reading some books about that and that whole, the evolution of that field basically. And I guess that brings up, anyway, before I get to this point, I think especially given the crisis, the climate change crisis. It's like, we have to be thinking about ecosystems. It's just so vital.
Yeah.
And even, and though like earlier was saying, like, oh, I don't like these little neat sort of academic logical arguments, like I actually find the ecosystem services argument super appealing and elegant. So I'm contradicting myself, but I don't know. There's something so, yeah, it's just so elegant the way that is being researched, I think, and presented, so that it, maybe that's just like the human nature. Like you can avoid these big questions of like, how do you feel about nature, and just go, oh, look at all the little things, all the big things that nature provides to you, including lowering risks of pandemics, so that keeps a lot of this pests and disease in its own sort of bubble. When things are working well, when we have these protective ecosystems, there's just so much benefit to humans. So you can avoid the complicated questions, yeah, and be selfish, but if you want to be, and
yes, it's like ecosystems. Enlightened selfishness.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Think about the future and future generations. We cannot just destroy all the forests and wild habitats. What I was going to say, the part that is difficult, I think, in terms of whether you're vegan or not, I guess, and thinking about ecosystems, is I think when we look at the history of indigenous cultures, and it's just something I've come across in reporting and reading, like, a lot of indigenous cultures certainly aren't vegan, but do a better job often of protecting threatened animals and habitats than necessarily we do. Whatever, but even if they're not vegan. So I guess that's part of my trepidation sometimes about saying like everybody be vegan or have that belief when again and again, coming across this history of, there's a great book called Perilous Bounty by Tom Philpott, who's an ag reporter. And I'm from California. A lot of it is about California. So admittedly, that was part of the deep dive that I like. But I had no idea so much of the history of mistreatment of natural resources in the state, and just that really all the sort of indigenous cultures were doing such a great job, basically, of like not doing that and minimizing their impact and being mindful of kind of the weather patterns and moving and just having this really like respectful treatment of the ecosystem, where instead of having too much livestock, flooding livestock, like all this horrible stuff that, and just, you know, obviously like taking advantage of, or not taking advantage, but sort of like draining the water as a resource, which we're seeing now as a huge problem today in California. So yeah, that sort of weighs on me in wanting to avoid absolutes, you know?
No, it makes sense. And I empathize with that as well, because it's interesting how it's presented these days, because sometimes that's put forward as a challenge to veganism, because it's almost challenging indigenous cultures where, you know, animal consumption or hunting is part of their way of living. And it's somewhat ironic it's presented that way, because indigenous cultures are much, much closer to a vegan way of life than industrialized Western agriculture.
100%.
So that's an interesting framing. But and I think you're right that because those different cultures around the world, going back many thousands of years around the world, were so much more intimately tied to their ecosystem, you couldn't afford to mess with it. But you had to respect it and revere it and look after it and make sure it was sustainable. So I think there's enormous value there, and so much more we could learn about how to live in harmony with nature. I would still say that if from a moral standpoint, what I'm doing is trying to take the perspective of the other, even in an indigenous culture, even in a super sustainable environment, I still wouldn't want to see needless harm done to a sentient being. That individual, that wild boar doesn't, or that pig doesn't really care too much whether it's being, you know, hunted with reverence in accordance with traditional customs, or whether it's having its throat slit in a slaughterhouse. So I would still go back to that point and say, I'd love to find ways, in the same ways I'd love to find ways of getting industrialized Western culture to have a just transition to a less harmful way of living. I'm sure there are ways we could ultimately, although they're probably not the priority now given the damage we do, but help even those indigenous cultures find ways of, as you're doing with your own cooking, veganizing the culture without losing the meaning and the rituals and the reverence. You know. But I think it's important to be sensitive to those things, because it's very easy to take a sort of universalizing, oversimplistic approach.
Well, and you're right, the sort of like protein obsessed thing is way more, particularly in the US, people think they have to get so much more protein than they actually need.
Yeah, yeah. More protein is a like bigger medical problem than too little, isn't it, as I understand it? Yeah,
like a tradition, obviously there's indigenous, there's not like one single thing, but like many traditional, like when we look historically, like you're talking about eating a lot less animals, I guess, in general than our current diet is today, yeah. Which is, yeah, like protein run amok. Everyone thinks they need so much.
Yeah. And the end state, as we come on to the final section of the conversation about the future, my personal end state would be that there basically is no such thing as animal farming or hunting or ideally exploitation at all. Now, that's maybe a crazy utopia, but, you know, I think it may one day be possible. But the core and the immediate problem for many people is industrialized factory farming, just given its scale and its brutality. And it's interesting that as we come to talk about the weirdness of human psychology, when it comes to factory farming, there's remarkable levels of consensus, even with people who do continue to consume animal products. There's some interesting surveys been done by the Sentience Institute, which showed that I think it was almost half of US adults, including those who consume meat and dairy, would, you know, like to see factory farming banned even while they continue to buy from it. Yeah, there's some interesting sort of latent ethics I think we can tap into here.
Yeah, I think one of the thing that I'm really interested in now is there are, it's the framing of kind of meat, basically, because I think there is, sometimes there's some confusion about, okay, so if I just replace my factory farm meat with regeneratively grazed meat, everything's good. And it's, no, that's not going to work. We have to actually eat less beef. If you're just from a climate perspective, it's the beef that has the, and lamb and the ruminants that have the biggest impact. But in a weird way, the factory farmed meat is the most efficient and best for climate. Again, getting rid of all other values, which like we don't want to do, obviously, but I'm just saying that's a hard thing for people to wrap their heads around, I think. There's a lot of wonderful benefits to regenerative farming that I report on, but it's not like you can, and I think this may be more, I'm sure this is more prevalent in the US, but you can't replace current levels of meat production or consumption with regenerative stuff and just think that solves the problem. And that's, I think that's a, sometimes the sort of factory farm framing is a little bit unhelpful because people got to get stuck there without thinking through what is the actual, is it the factory that's the problem? Yes, in some cases, but it's not the entire problem. It's also this huge land use from beef and lambs grazing and the raising the feed and all that stuff. So getting people to go past the labels of factory farming, just the immediate top level sort of talking points and digging into the facts. That's what I've always been interested in the stuff I cover, but trying to get into that nuance. Like in the beginning, I was covering GMOs and stuff like that. It was another thing where people were like, I just know that word and not necessarily digging past that.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that's the final part of the conversation is thinking about the future. And I'm interested in people's views for, you know, intra-human ethics, for obviously this big beast of a problem about, from my perspective, animal farming and animal exploitation, but more broadly, the environment and climate as well. And I'm interested in your view, one of maybe a more utopian possibility, right? If we could flick a switch and have 8 billion people who have a more generous, broad compassion, take a more naturalistic approach, you know, less tribalism, what could that more utopian future look like? But I'm also interested, given your work, in how do you think we can get there? Because we've touched on these topics already about logic and facts and moral reasoning and habits and behaviors and community and culture, and humans are pretty strange, and just being able to win a technical argument doesn't drive change. So that's a super broad question, but I'm interested in your view of where we might get to and productive ways of driving positive changes.
Interesting. I'm just reporting on a story now about the, if we were to transition to a meat-free future, what does that look like? Mm. And it's really complicated because there's, back to that efficiency thing, there's people who, there's experts who basically would, this is like the path to get there, who would not want to cut back on production in the US or places that are really efficient at all, and just maximize what you can get for the land we already have dedicated to growing meat in order to avoid deforestation in other places. There's that side. This is the land sparing, land sharing debate that's happening a bit in agriculture. And then there are people who just want to overhaul the whole entire system, basically. But
like, have these people heard of plants? Is one of my
I think it's like looking at the, like, I'm talking about like World Resources Institute. I think when you look, it's like the big scale of it. It's not going to happen tomorrow. So it's like, when we look, even if, you know, we look at reducing consumption and just looking at how huge the meat industry is now, like that's going to be a long path. path to get there.
Yeah.
But some of the interesting things are like talking to contract poultry farmers and hog farmers who are like, I am done. I want to get out of this because, and for them, it's mostly financial. Although there are a couple I met who have gone vegan, in fact, but they're for health reasons, various basically philosophical shifts that have are in their own life. But for a lot of them, they're locked into these really bad contracts that have made them, they're saddled with a lot of debt. And so that's their motivation to get out.
They're essentially trapped by the corporation that's contracted them in.
Yeah, because the contract will say you have to build these steel farms to this specification. And then after a few years, it's like, oh, now you have to add this. And that requires further debt.
And you can only sell to that company pretty much, given the locations.
And so replacing that is the struggle. Like, okay, so if I'm going to now grow mushrooms or hemp, I don't have the Tyson Foods of hemp to just sell to. Or mushrooms. So it's, okay, now I got to find like some restaurants and maybe some smoothie companies who want mushrooms for protein powder.
And there's some great, initiatives like Mercy for Animals Transformation and Rancher Advocacy Program and Miyoko's Creamery. They're tiny little chipping away at the edge compared to the scale of animal production.
But and I think a huge component of it is going to be government policy. And for those farmers in that little, just that little section, it's the debt is so massive that you have to see some forgiveness of the debt, subsidies, stuff like that, if you really want to get that transition happening there. Yeah. And then there's some movements around like growing more pea protein and stuff like that in the US. So it's more about like giving more markets for American farmers necessarily than getting people to go plant-based. So there's all kinds of interesting, it really depends on the crops and the, for a lot of the experts, I think they're thinking about what are the financial incentives, not can we morally, can we convince everyone to go vegan basically, which no surprise there. But you do, I think, see a lot of more people, I think, just from readers anyway, caring about these issues, mostly spurred by climate, it seems. But even I think just having a bigger market for plant-based foods, having more stuff on the market, the attention it gets, it does start a conversation, I think, at least, even if it's not necessarily getting everyone to immediately eat more plants. But it's the start. I think all of this stuff is just sort of like early days. Yeah. And like, how do we get to this big utopian future? I don't know. Yeah. I feel like what I try to do is just report the facts and talk, present information that people might not know. Like, even in this piece, it's like, maybe people haven't thought about what a plant-based future would look like. And so at least it's like starting the conversation of here's all the complications of that, but here are some of the people starting to work on it. Yeah. And so it kind of hopefully plants a seed of people starting to think about, we hear a lot about what we need to do by 2050 and all these sort of future deadlines looming. And I think breaking those down into specifics as much as possible at least gets people hopefully starting to think about it.
Yeah, I think that's enormously powerful. And it's partly because it does feel like there's something in the zeitgeist that's shifting around these topics, partly driven by climate and concerns for, you know, human health as well as animal ethics. I think it, in some countries at least, is shifting meaningfully. And it's easier to consider now, as well as you said, you know, the availability of different products and just the cultural acceptance is shifting. Certainly in the US and the UK, it feels like veganism is where vegetarianism was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. It does feel like things have shifted, but not enough to make an appreciable difference. But things are moving. But partly because of that, I think your work on, okay, we need to actually get more specific about where we're going to go next and what this future might look like and lay it out. It's not just enough to say, here's a problem anymore. You can actually talk about transitions and subsidies and laws and policies and regulations and incentives, you know, just transitions for farmers and so on. And so there's something really powerful about actually laying out the practical steps for how to get
there. I think it's fascinating to me. And I try to challenge myself. I think it's impossible to be free of bias. And I think when I started thinking about these things or reporting on these things, I was more of a kind of efficiency side person too. I thought there's just something, that sort of, it's very appealing. It's just the numbers. You can, there's something appealing about it. As I kept reporting, I realized like, it makes no sense to just be, and even to just be focused on the efficiency. And even folks from World Resources Institute would say the same thing. They're like, if we were just worried about efficiency, everyone could just eat like candy bars, basically, because that's super efficient, like great for greenhouse gases. And like, but if we never thought about human health and all these other topics, sure. But so I think I tried to, and I was a little more like skeptical, I think, of regenerative movements in the beginning. I tried to challenge myself just to always look at make sure to talk to a wide range of experts and question myself, like, am I leaning too heavily to one side or something like that? Yeah. And I think that's, you know, helpful for everybody to do more often if you can. Put yourself in the other person's shoes.
Yeah. And I think it is partly because there's so many different lines of thought and so many different rationales. And there's a lot of motivated reasoning, of course, and there's motivated reasoning from people like me who have a moral, you know, imperative, right? So I'm looking for any possible reason that will support my argument. But there's motivated reasoning for people for whom animal farming and consumption is a integral part of their identity and their culture. And they'll come up with any excuse to justify continuing to do it in some way. So it's useful to, you know, be able to come up that with both of those things with a fresh set of eyes and to examine and challenge it.
Yeah, definitely. Sure, the political alignments of farmers, there's this feeling of that's caught up in what rural America means. There's so many, different, I think, attachments to like why we have certain beliefs, for sure.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see how some related industries have shifted over time as well. So if you look back at the history of the tobacco industry, if you look at fossil fuel industries, and you look at now, I think, where the animal agriculture industries are, quite often there's some very interesting patterns of funded research and PR and marketing and messaging and political lobbying. And it's quite interesting to look at the different parallels there as the interest groups play through.
There's a lot of that. And I've looked into that a lot and reported on that a little bit on the livestock industry side. And I think I've tried to separate out even sort of plant-based industry when you're getting that point of view versus an independent researcher, and to try to, because you listen, I'm living in a capitalist world. That's all, like, I am above it all, but it's just, you have to always, if you're getting a marketing message, you have to take a step back and look at why you're getting that. I think you saw that a lot with plant-based companies taking advantage of the health halo of those products and things like that. It just taking a step back and questioning why certain messages are the way they are and all that stuff.
Some healthy skepticism. And I think one of the other positive forces that journalism can have, it can be positive and negative, is partly how it frames the moral question and whether it even engages with the moral question. So when you read almost any tier one media about the animal product industries, the experiences of the individual animals within the process is essentially almost never touched at all. It's just not a topic, right? So it's about climate, it's about efficiency, it's about the industry, it's about product, it's about animals are described in terms of tonnage or volume rather than as individuals. And that's one of the things I'm really encouraged by, is the number of journalists, including yourself, and I interviewed Henry Mounts recently from the Financial Times, who are willing to flip that and talk about those other issues as well, but at least recognize that there is an ethical question here at the heart of it too. And if we can do the hard work of spanning that species boundary and taking the perspective of the sentient individual at the other end of this process, that's got to be something that we take into account as we work through these breathtakingly complex problems as well.
Yeah, and it's tough because for certain outlets, editors have pressure to get eyeballs on the page.
Yeah.
So people are Googling like healthiest plant-based burger and they're not Googling the inner life of a chicken. I'm sure they're not Googling that. Yeah. So like then there's just sort of the system we have where people are like, well, we want to have the SEO match up what people are looking for. And then it's a lot of clever editors are like, okay, so we'll get a few sentences in there. They'll give you some leeway, but it's a real struggle to try to, you want to report on things and present new angles, and you also have, it's also a business, so you also have to assignment. I have to, so those are, I think, a lot of the struggles in journalism right now.
Yeah. And given all of that, how optimistic do you feel about that space generally? Do you think we're seeing the early signs of some systemic shifts, or about the animal, I guess primarily the animal farming, climate, environment, that sort of cluster of related challenges? Do you think humans are going to be able to crack our own psychology enough to change quickly enough? Or
I'm by nature a Gen X doom and gloomer. I think that's part of why some of these questions I've always tried to avoid. Because, oh God, like I don't, who has that much faith in humanity? I don't know. I think in recent years, I think about more, not what's helpful is to not think about like humanity, because that's like too hard to figure out. but I think about, okay, so there's my, with my family, there's me, then there's like the circle of people I know locally, and those are a few different groups, and what are they asking about? What do they care about? And would, like, can I get past two sentences about something related to like animals with them versus experts on Twitter? And that, and there's all these different sort of silos of folks. And so I just think about conversations I have in those, all those different silos, and seeing how they progress. And I do think, God, it like sounds cheesy, but it starts with you. So it starts with myself. And if I could push back in a non-lecturing kind of way,
yeah,
then I think those lead to very productive conversations. And that comes up with all things, vaccines, what's in our food, like everything. You have to be able to be an active listener and hear people's concerns. And then before you offer your point of view or what's helpful. And I definitely, I think, when I first started writing, I did more argument pieces, and I think I was like, no, you're wrong, because like I have these points all set up, and then they're like, ah, I don't want to talk to you anymore.
Yeah, so the people who agreed with you were absolutely loving it, and everybody else was, yeah.
Yeah, and you still see that today, and I'm not like, who wants to be in this little echo chamber anymore, where it's just, I tweeted my zinger, and then the people, your little fans retweet that, are like, yes, you're so brave, but I can't stand that anymore. And I can't say like I didn't play some part myself in early days of social media. Like I definitely was a zinger person, sure, but you've got to be able to move on past that. Don't we all want to search for something new in our lives that's a better conversation than just like our own little echo chamber and the people who agree with you are just applauding? That doesn't get us anywhere.
Yeah And it's understandable why people operate that way, and I often do as well, because when a topic is really important to you, whether it's animal ethics or whether it's vaccinations and anti-vaxxing or whether it's climate or some sort of human ethics thing, when you've seen an issue in a way that makes you highly confident you're on the right side of history and you've really got this thing and you understand it and it's egregious or there's something really bad about it, your instinctive response is righteousness, preachiness, assertiveness, send off that zinger, winning the argument. And this is obviously something that the veganist move might t-shirt are known for. And I completely understand that, because once you've seen it, it is egregious. And I can imagine that people who've been on the right side of many human ethics challenges and social changes felt that same sense of how do people not get this?
But I guess I just have to say, I don't want to sound like I'm like, I also have a long history of like activism in my family. So I feel like there also is that tendency to be like, listen, if everyone were just nicer to each other, like, let's not mention these like complicated things. And so I definitely don't want to sound like that person, because to me, no. I have the greatest respect for activists. And if you feel that righteousness that righteousness is correct, go forth and protest. And that starts the conversation in its own way too. Everyone has different roles in these.
There can be a role for it, and a couple of people I've interviewed are quite full-on on that. They're like, no, shame works, and you can, I wouldn't have done this change if I hadn't been challenged. And it does work for some people. I think there is a place for it, but by and large, I don't think that type of tone is going to drive positive change quickly enough. It doesn't have a wide enough appeal. And in a sense, I come back to part of this sentientism idea is one of universal compassion for all sentient beings, but that also includes compassion for yourself. And it also includes compassion even for the other humans you disagree with. And that's, if anything, that's the hardest thing, right? To recognize that we all have a history, we all have a culture, we all were brought up in certain ways, we all think certain things are normal, we have a massive diversity of opinions, we're not our own fault in a deep sense, right? And understanding our own personal histories hopefully can help us engage with compassion, find the common ground where there is common ground, and work to understand each other. And that doesn't mean, to your point, that doesn't mean you're being weak or you're appeasing or you're ignoring issues. You can still have a fairly steely view about what's right and what's wrong or where we need to go. But just the way you engage, I think a more universally compassionate approach, one is ethically better, but it's actually probably on average more effective as a way of communicating too. But
And I think recognizing, I'm just thinking a sort of big picture, like where you have privilege in a conversation. It's easy for me to, as a white person, to get into a conversation and not feel that like personal harm on certain issues. Whereas,
yeah, we could just speak, right?
Yeah, of course. It's not like feeling that personal exhaustion of, as a Jewish person, feel like I'm going to take on an anti-Semite. Like that's harmful. harmful. That's actual harm. Those are tough things, but I guess I try to look at, if it's a space where I feel like I have some privilege to have the conversation, I will try to push myself to take it on more, as opposed to somebody who maybe doesn't have that privilege, or in the conversation, it does come at like greater personal cost to them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Cool. That's an inspiring message to finish on, I think. Is there anything else you wanted to cover in the conversation, or any other aspects of our bold utopian future that even as a doomsayer, you want to draw out for us?
I feel like, I guess I am, like, it's so funny. I feel like in having this conversation, I've realized I'm just like this weird mix of super realist, like doom and gloom, and then some sort of like positivity in there from Santa Cruz that I guess just I couldn't quite get rid
of. You can't hold the hope in forever. So it's going to leak out.
It was fun to see that, to realize that in this conversation.
It was a real pleasure. And you being a guest here, hopefully is doing another little bit to help normalize broadly rational, compassionate thinking, which is the plan. We're trying to persuade all 7.8 billion people to become sentientists and then thereby solve all the world's problems. So
easy peasy.
Yeah, just watch. Yeah. Thank you so much again. What's the best way of people following you and reading your work, and what's your favorite social media? I can include links in the show notes, of course, so don't worry too much, but where would you point people?
Mostly Twitter is my favorite still. It was just Jenny's Twitter. I'm trying to do more on Instagram, but I'm still, as my kid puts it, cringy. I haven't really mastered that medium. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm there too. Although I've insisted to my daughter that I'm not a boomer because I'm the wrong age. Apparently being a boomer is it's a mindset thing. So apparently, I can be a boomer even without being a boomer. But yeah, so I struggle with Instagram too.
I've had this conversation many times. No, I'm not a boomer. That's my parents. Please. Exactly, how dare you?
Yeah. Cool. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you, Jenny. Thanks again. I'll let you get on with the rest of your day and stay in touch.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?